Oh, it's a real pleasure to be here. This is a wonderful place. I've enjoyed visiting so far. So, in some sense, so I think so 2 years ago at the Cornell Topology Conference, Bill Thurston gave a really nice talk, where one feature of which, though startlingly enough, was that he admonished all of us to, now that we've made these strides in the field, to repackage and write up and rewrite. All of these new results. So, while that may not have happened in due course, I think that conferences like this represent a good opportunity to take stock once again. So that's kind of what I'd like to do. So the title of my talk is the geometry of hyperbolic three manifolds. And the actual title is via Heegaard splittings, but I'm going to say various things in and around Heegaard splittings, okay? Okay, but in some sense, the broader goal is to try to develop a more effective picture of the geometry of hyperbolic three manifolds, whether they be closed, finite volume, infinite volume. And so because now we're at a stage where some of these cases are well understood, there's a certain amount of kind of historical unpacking that needs to be done. So by effective, essentially the idea is that you want some more than just uniqueness statements or rigidity statements, you want some kinds of estimates on the geometry, however precise. Okay? So let's see. So I'll move over here actually. So there's kind of two, well, there are many sorts, but there's, of course, some of the best theorems in this area are what are called rigidity theorems. So those are sort of uniqueness theorems for hyperbolic three manifolds based on some collection of data. And so most notably, there's the Mostow rigidity theorem, which essentially says that if N is closed, then, and hyperbolic, then there exists a unique hyperbolic structure or a unique representation of pi 1 from pi 1 of n to PSL 2c up that's discrete and faithful up to conjugacy. Okay, so this says all you need to know is the topology of n, or even its fundamental group, to determine the hyperbolic structure uniquely. Okay? So, but I emphasize that we don't really know much about N from this information. Okay, you start with the fundamental group. Okay, what's the volume of N? What's the length of the shortest geodesic? Things like this. Okay? So, and then Prasad proved the same thing when boundary of N is a union of tori. Okay? So finite volume case. Well, likewise, in the infinite volume case, well, as a result of work over the last 4 years or so, when pi 1 of N is finitely generated, and N admits some hyperbolic metric. Okay, so the interior of N, really, admit some complete hyperbolic metric, then one can make exactly similar rigidity statement based on certain input data in addition to the topology. Okay, so then a hyperbolic structure, so representation from pi 1 of N to PSL 2C, is uniquely determined . Okay, so we saw various talks about this last week in the mini course, and if you weren't here for that, it's too bad, but essentially there's three pieces of information. Okay, there's the topology of what's called a compact core for M, the locus of parabolic elements for the fundamental group, and then some data here, new, called the end invariant data. Okay, so Ken talked a little bit about this yesterday. So this is the ELT, the ending lamination thingy. Okay, so the end together with the tameness theorem. Okay, so tying it all together, it's work of Ian Agle, Danny Caligari, and David Gabay independently, and then joint work of Mazur Minsky, work of Minsky, and work of myself and Dick Canary together with Yair Minsky. Okay, so this is again a rigidity statement. It's a classification statement in terms of some input information. Okay, but there's a sort of related point here, which is that this factors through a strong understanding of the geometry of what certain cases look like. Okay, so up here I'll put model geometry. So in particular, the proof goes through an understanding of a Bi-Lipschitz model, at least for the case when M is homeomorphic to the product of the surface with the real line. Okay, so here the idea is that if we are careful about how we specify things, so if M is S cross R and say P is empty for the moment, then there exists a combinatorial three-manifold M sub nu together with a Bi-Lipschitz F sub nu to M. Okay? So another famous rigidity theorem in the subject, known as Sullivan's rigidity theorem, tells you that this is enough information to solve the classification problem in the case when M, well, even has the homotopy type of a surface. Okay, but it's more information. It gives you information about what curves are short, how the volume grows. Again, we saw some nice results about this last week. But there are cases left untouched by this. So other cases, in particular, the model theorem, it's enough to solve the problem, but we don't have a complete model for the case when, say, M is homeomorphic to a handle body, H. What we have is a model for everything but some compact piece of the manifold, and that's enough to solve the problem. But we'd like to know, we don't know how big that compact piece is. Okay, and there are various other cases that aren't handled directly by the S cross R case. Yes, Lee.
Mm-hmm. Is that in principle
Well, okay, so, I mean, some model exists because the ending lamination conjecture is true. So, in other words, you have some hyperbolic manifold that's sitting there. That is a geometric model for any hyperbolic manifold without ending lamination. The question is, how do you start, and this is really the key here. So, this starts with some a priori data, okay, this end invariant new, and builds somehow from scratch in the lab this combinatorial object that happens to be by Lipschitz to M. Okay? So that's the kind of... So what I'm saying, I guess, is that combinatorial procedure, it's unclear how to proceed in the case of the handle body, just from the combinatorics in the surface cross R case. Okay? So similarly, what about the case when the volume is finite? Okay, well, there's one case that's kind of handled completely, which I'll say a little bit about, which is the case of the three manifold that fibers over the circle. Okay. If you have a hyperbolic three manifold that fibers over the circle, well, you can build a model for it directly from the S cross R case by passing through the cover corresponding to the fiber, because we can understand that manifold in this way. But what about the kinds of things Juan was talking about yesterday, where you have M given as a Heegaard splitting? Okay, well, that's got a nice surface. It's the gluing surface for the splitting. It would seem, perhaps, that one could import some of this information from the S cross R setting into the Heegaard splitting case. Okay, so these are the kinds of challenges that we're engaged in. And okay, when I say we, there's various different players here. So some of what I'm going to talk about is joint work with Juan Soto, but there's also in play now new joint work with Soto, Minsky, and Namasi. So, all right, so, but the idea is to work from some kind of combinatorial description of a three-manifold, whether it's via a fibering or via a Heegaard splitting, and extract geometric information. So what kind of geometric information? Well, sort of a first test, good test case is something like the volume. Another test case is, you know, some sort of geometric model. And then what kind of applications? Well, I'll just say this much. I mean, so work of Namasi shows that in his thesis, he gave a sufficient condition for at least for some kinds of Heegaard splittings to admit negatively curved metrics and very, very close to hyperbolic. And by a theorem of Tian, these, once you're close enough to being hyperbolic in a certain sense, you are hyperbolic. Okay, so if we have good enough control over what the geometry of hyperbolic free manifolds is supposed to look like, perhaps this is an avenue to approaching a proof of hyperbolization, at least in some cases, that starts with these kinds of notions. Okay, which so that's just propaganda. Okay, so once again, in the case, so a sort of sample case, we have the three-manifold fibering over the circle, which is hyperbolic. Well, then M is just a gluing S cross 0, 1 by, okay, by some diffeomorphism. And Thurston showed, so M is hyperbolic if and only if psi is pseudo-Nossov, Okay, so there's topological ways to formulate this notion that basically you act freely on the set of isotopy classes as a diffeomorphism of simple, essential simple closed curves, or as Lee was describing, you have some action, so psi acts on the Teichmuller space with kind of, well, north-south or east-west in this case, dynamics. Okay. And, okay, so, but you have a nice cover, and some psi tilde, which is just H3 corresponding to the fiber. And, well, first of all, kind of sample theorem before the model is that you can estimate the volume of this. So up to a multiplicative constant, depending only on the topology of the fiber, the volume of M sub psi is an int over all Pantz decompositions, P, of the distance between P and psi of P. Okay, so Pantz decompositions are, of course, what you think they are. Here's a Pantz decomposition. What is a distance? Well, distance is a minimal number of moves in the Pantz graph. So what's a move? Two kinds of moves. One that does something like this. And one that does to use every color possible. Okay, so here what have you done? You've replaced one curve with another curve that intersects it minimally in the complement of the remaining curves. In the first case, this purple curve lies on a four-hold sphere in the complement of the remaining curves. In this case, the red curve lies on a one-hold torus in the complement of the remaining curves. And in each case, you have minimal intersection number among all possible moves. Okay, so this is sort of move one, move two, and this distance just measures how many moves it takes to get from P to, well, psi of P, which is just the image under the diffeomorphism of the Pantz decomposition, which is again a Pantz decomposition. Okay, it is related. I mean, somehow this is the wayward stepchild of the curve complex. Okay, so there's some sort of notion of distance from the curve complex, but it can be arbitrarily off from the distance in the Pantz complex. The Pantz complex, in some sense, records more information about how the surface has changed as you move from a surface, say, where these curves have bounded length to another one where the new Pantz decomposition has bounded length. Okay, so it is bounded from below, if you like, by the distance in the curve complex, but it can be arbitrarily off. It's, well, given that Zeno just talked about this, this is sort of related to the, it's related to the Vey-Peterson metric, okay, by uniformly bounded error. Okay, so that's one kind of piece of combinatorial, I mean, piece of geometric information that one obtains from combinatorics, but it's subsumed by the model theorem in this S cross R case because of the fact that M sub psi tilde has a Bi-Lipschitz model depending only on nu minus and nu plus. Okay? So one can simply take this Bi-Lipschitz model, find a suitable surface, consider its translate by the corresponding deck transformation coming from the fiber direction, and now the intervening product, so this is This is now a copy of S cross I. If you glue the minus end to the plus end of this, you have a geometric model for the three manifolded fibers over the circle now. Okay? So I won't go into the details of the kinds of things that these invariants tell you about what this model looks like, but in particular, they tell you whether this has lower bound to its injectivity radius. If it doesn't, what the short curves in this product region look like, and in particular, what its volume is. Okay? So, and again, this is all just coming from the combinatorics of the mapping class psi. So all we needed to know was what psi does to the surface topologically. Okay, so, well, how about Heegaard splitting? Okay, so if we assume M is hyperbolic, well, so how can we estimate volume? Well, for various reasons, pants decompositions are a good place to look. So where do you see pants decompositions in the setting of Heegaard splittings? Well, a Heegaard splitting is a gluing of two handle bodies, and well, there are many interesting pants decompositions on a handle body. One could consider, say, a pants decomposition consisting of meridians, for example. Unfortunately, there are sort of too many. Okay? So then it's a good idea then to consider some sort of minimization process using the pants distance again. Okay, so we'll define various sort of nice sets here. So first of all, what are these curves that I've drawn? So given a handle body H, alpha essential on boundary H is a meridian if alpha bounds a disk. Okay, T sub alpha. So then in the pants graph, let's see, I'm not sure I said. So you can think of the set of all pants decompositions as a graph with vertices corresponding to pants decomps and edges elementary moves. Okay. So now we can consider then for a Heegaard splitting the pants decomposition on the Heegaard surface, or just in the case of a handle body, we can consider on the handle body the pants decompositions of the boundary, say that consist of meridians. Okay, so this is some subset. So where P such that alpha in P implies alpha is a meridian. Okay. So perhaps what I'll do, there's a way to estimate volume similar to this for hyperbolic Heegaard splittings. But because of what I want to talk about in a minute, I think what I'm going to do is state it in the case when M is thick. Okay, so when M is thick, this means that the injectivity radius when M is less than some constant epsilon, we have the following. Okay, so this is Juan Soto. That if M is what's called a strongly irreducible splitting, then the volume of M is again estimated by a multiplicative constant depending only on the Heegaard surface by the Pants distance from the set of meridional Pants decompositions on the first handle body to the set of meridional Pants decompositions on the second. Okay, so these will be sort of complicated with respect to the first one. Now, I'll remark, because I've given this talk before, various people have seen it, that there is a sort of an asterisk here if you want to get rid of the assumption that the manifold is thick. There's a modification of this set required essentially due to the fact that cusps in a hyperbolic 3-manifold have bounded volume. Okay, so when you kind of are sweeping through the manifold estimating the volume, at some point you can sort of happen on a bounded volume piece that nevertheless contributes to distance in this sense. However, by assuming the manifold's thick, you don't have any such very short curves, and this is enough to give a correct estimate. So the general strategy for the proof here works perfectly well in this setting. It's not, in fact, how I did this case, but the upper bound is. So let me just say a little bit about the proof, and then I want to see where the philosophy of the proof takes us. Okay. Okay, so again, the idea here is you've got this hyperbolic manifold. Let's see, I didn't say what strongly irreducible means. Okay, so strongly irreducible means that, well, in fact, if you look at any meridian on one side and any meridian on the other side, that they intersect at least twice. Okay. If alpha is a meridian for H1, beta meridian for H2, then they have non-zero intersection. Okay, and in fact, I'm going to make another mild simplifying assumption, which is that it's really strongly irreducible. Okay, So what is really strongly irreducible means, it means that in fact these curves, alpha and beta, have distance in the curve complex or the curve graph. Okay, I think this was X this morning, but okay, C for curve complex, at least 3. Okay, so let me just remind you what is, so the curve graph, it looks like this kind of construction, where now the vertices are just single simple closed curves vertices are isotopy classes of simple closed curves, essential, so not homotopically trivial, and edges join pairs alpha beta with alpha beta of intersection number 0. Okay? So somehow it takes a couple of steps, and 3 to be precise at least, to move from the set of meridians on one side to the set of meridians on the other. Okay, so I'll say why this is needed in a second. Okay, but in the first In the first pass, we remark that in fact, in both cases, the bounds from above on volume are straightforward. Okay, so why is this? Well, essentially, this comes from the fact that you can start with the closest pair, the nearest pair of Pansky decompositions, one in P of H1, the other in P of H2. Take a geodesic joining them in the Pansky graph of the boundary, and then construct a kind of ideal triangulation for the manifold. Okay, what does that mean? There's no cusps in this manifold, but sort of almost are. Okay, so the upper bound comes from the following. So let G be a shortest path from P of H1 to P of H2 in the Pansky graph of the Heegaard surface, S, I guess I called it. Okay. So now we have some sequence of Pansky compositions joining what? Well, two Pansky compositions, one P1, that consists entirely of meridians, and the other P2, that consists entirely of meridians. Okay, so then there's a way to build a triangulation, or an ideal triangulation, of a manifold obtained by drilling out the curves that arise in this as curves in the Pansky compositions along the sequence, or if the curve is already a meridian, just collapsing it to a single base point, and taking an ideal triangulation of what's left. Okay, so one can create a kind of, so here's handle body on one side, a drilled version of S cross R moving from one handle body to the other. Okay? And some kind of triangulation of this drilled S cross R where the vertices of the tetrahedra are out in the cusps. Okay? So this gives an upper bound on the volume in terms of this whole picture, in terms of the number of tetrahedra. Okay? So the volume is bounded by some constant times the number of tetrahedra. Okay, but the hyperbolic three-manifold in question, M, is simply a Dehn filling on this picture. Okay? So Dehn fill to obtain M, the original M, and Dehn filling decreases volume. Okay, so what I didn't say here was that the number of tetrahedra, well, it only requires some bounded number, say 6 or something, to accomplish each step. So you have 6 tetrahedra, 6 tetrahedra at most. Sometimes it's less as you move across. Okay? So then this looks like some other constant, C times the distance. Okay? And that bounds the Dehn filled one. Okay, so similar, exactly similar argument works in the case with the fiber, where you take the minimal length path from P to psi of P, you can drill along all the curves that arise there. Yeah?
Why do you have to go through the whole thing? Why can't you just build a calculation temporarily?
You can. You can. You can. So, it's just that, well, anyway, you have to spin at some point. So you, it's clear here that the number of tetrahedra in the triangulation is exactly some constant times the number of elementary moves. There is a finite triangulation of the manifold that may have some extra tetrahedra that don't really contribute to volume because they're just occurring in a thin part. They're wrapping around a thin part of the manifold. And you can cancel out that contribution to volume by sort of doing Thurston's construction of spinning the triangulation. Okay, so that's morally the same thing as the Dane filling procedure. Or that's unspinning it, I guess. Yeah. That's right. So that's right. Yeah, so I'm proving this sort of Heegaard splitting case. It works equally well in the setting if you started with a hyperbolic handle body. Okay, so a hyperbolic structure on the interior of the handle body, and you were estimating the volume of the convex core of that hyperbolic handle body. Okay, so what's the input data? Well, you take the, let's see, I guess I said I was starting with this thick case already, didn't I? So maybe I don't need to worry about this. You take a bounded length fancy decomposition on the boundary, on the convex core boundary, and shoot to take the shortest path to, in this case it would just be P of H, the set of meridional pansy compositions there. Okay? So I'll come to that in a second, actually. Yes? Well, there's a couple of ways you can think about it. One is that you can actually just think in terms of bounding the volume of S cross R, okay, and with the Pansky composition marked as, say, cusp or something like that on the end, or just as bounded length curves, and then you're just attaching a bounded volume handle body at the end of the day. So if the curves correspond to disks, you get equally well a triangulation of the S cross R part by just collapsing the vertices to base points, some fixed base point. What's left over is a bunch of three chains with bounded area boundary. And a three chain with bounded area boundary in a hyperbolic manifold has bounded volume. Okay? Okay, so, but really the interesting part here is, another question? An abelian three-chain. So you end up, you end up with an abelian three-chain, which is, so you have a bunch of either just balls, So you're talking about a Pansky composition. So what's left is actually a bunch of just S2s. Excuse me. Yeah, I misspoke. Okay, so you have a bunch of S2s with bounded area boundary when you've capped off the disks. Those bound a bounded volume ball. Okay? Sorry. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, so let me just quickly say what the point is for getting a lower bound on the volume, or alternatively, bounding the pants distance by the volume. So how to bound okay, so here let me say that the same theorem in the case when M is homeomorphic to the interior of a handle body, okay, where now the input data is, so the volume then of the convex, so we're measuring the volume of the convex core of M, and it's comparable now to the distance between some preferred Pansky composition corresponding to the convex core and its distance to this set of meridional density compositions. Again here, let's assume that the injectivity radius is at least epsilon. So here, what's P of X? Well, I have this handle body. It has a hyperbolic surface intrinsically bounding the convex core boundary. There's some density composition on it, all of whose curves have bounded length. So this surface is X now, and the length on X of alpha is less than some constant depending only on the genus and bears for each alpha in P of X. Okay, so then we measure the distance in the pants graph from this pants decomposition down to the meridional ones, and that gives an estimate for the volume. So essentially, how do we reduce to this kind of case? Well, the strongly irreducible condition tells me by a theorem of Pitts and Rubinstein there exists a minimal surface isotopic to the Heegaard surface S in X. Okay? So then I can cut along this minimal surface. Let's call it X. And what I'm left with is a handle body that's hyperbolic. It's no longer complete, but it has minimal boundary. And essentially, this behaves like the convex core of a hyperbolic handle body from the point of view of, well, doing things like interpolating surfaces and taking geometric limits. Okay, so we have a kind of a picture where we now have some minimal surface X, H1, H2, and now we're going to estimate the volume of one side. If we can bound the pants distance from X to the meridians, from a bounded length pants decomposition on X to the meridians, and bound it from X back to the other set of meridians, and we've bounded in terms of the volume the pants distance between the two sets of meridians. Okay, so suffices. Well, after a bit of messing around, to estimate, to prove this case. Okay. Well, so now there's the mystery, the black magic of geometric limits. Okay, so somehow, what do geometric limits arguments do? Well, they tell you that the sort of the range of pictures that you can be seeing with the appropriate compactness statement doesn't vary too much. So sort of you have a bounded set of pictures. So what in practice this means is you can say, assume that the thing you want to be true fails more and more in a sequence of examples, well, then there's some geometric limit. And in fact, the geometric limit looked like one of these sort of bounded range of possible pictures you can see. And this contradicts the fact that the thing you wanted to hold is failing more and more. Okay, so in practice, what does this mean? Well, if we start with our handle body, M, and we have this convex core boundary surface X, what we'd like to do is sweep out a definite volume piece of the convex core to obtain a new surface, say X1, where we've moved definite volume, but we haven't changed the pants distance more than a bounded amount. Okay? If we can say this and then continue to say it, then each step we eat up more and more volume. So we eat up definite volume, but our pants distance is remaining bounded. So when we're done at the end of the day, we've swept out the volume and we've bounded the total pants distance by the number of times we had to take a new block. So how do we find this surface x1? So we claim there exists x1 with the volume of the little interval bundle between x and x1. So this is an embedded surface close enough to being negatively curved, such that the volume is, at least 1, and that the distance between this bounded length Pansky composition on x and a similar bounded length Pansky composition on x1 I need to get my quantifiers right here. Okay, so the claim is there exists L and D so that if the length on X of the shortest meridian is at least L, then there exists X1 embedded in M such that the volume, so let's just say the volume from X to X1 is at least 1, and the pants distance between bounded length Pansky compositions on X and on X1 is at most D. Okay. Well, how does this go? You imagine that in a sequence of hyperbolic structures on a handle body, that this condition is failing more and more. Okay, so that the length of the shortest meridian is tending to infinity, and that no such surface exists. Okay, but we were assuming all along that the injectivity radius is bounded below, in particular the injectivity radius on X is bounded below, so there is a Gromov-Hausdorff limit. Okay, so M infinity. And what does M infinity look like? Well, since the length of the shortest meridian on the surface X is tending to infinity, there's no meridian in the limit. Okay, so now X is incompressible. So there's a limit surface X infinity and X in M infinity, and X infinity is now incompressible. So the idea is now that this limiting manifold is what we refer to as a bounded geometry product . Okay, so it in fact looks, it's modeled by the universal curve over a Teichmuller geodesic in the thick part of Teichmuller space. Well, so if the geometric limit has this form, then it's a standard thing that there's a nice product region in it. Okay, so we have a model thanks to here that looks like this bounded geometry manifold. So we can map this back and find our desired product region of definite volume where the Pansky distance is bounded, because the Pansky distance will be bounded in the geometric limit between any two homotopic surfaces. Okay? So find the product region in the limit and push back to approximates. Well, I was trying to elide this fact. So why is the limit not geometrically finite? I mean, there are various ways to see this. One is that the set of meridians has to be converging to something with bounded geometry. There is an ending lamination for it. So there's some non-realizable lamination in the limit, for those of you who know what that means. And this is, it means that the limit is degenerate. Yeah. It's also strong, because there's no parabolics. Okay? So now I've just done one step, and I was also assuming that the length of the shortest meridian is at least L. Okay? Well, what this says is by a similar argument applied now to X1, I can find X2, provided the length of the shortest meridian is at least L. So when do I have to stop? Well, I have to do something different when I see a meridian whose length is bounded by this L. Well, what do? I just pinch it. That's what meridians are good for. Okay, so I've moved along, and now suddenly I see a meridian with some bounded length, and I can collapse it to a disk. And I'm left with a picture like this. Okay? So what is this picture? Well, it's sort of a two-dimensional projection of a three-dimensional thing. So here's my surface, and there's a disk on it that has bounded. Well, if I have a bounded length meridian, it bounds a nice bounded area disk in the hyperbolic manifold. And so now I have two new surfaces with bounded geometry of lower genus on which I can run exactly the same geometric limit argument. Okay, so the length of the shortest meridian here is at least L. Well, then I can continue. Yeah?
This is when you've fallen below the magic number L.
You've fallen below the magic number, you can pinch something. Okay? And now I need to say, well, I'm continuing to accrue pants distance. And there's a mildly subtle point here, which is that now I'm continuing to accrue pants distance in a in what looks like a lower genus surface. So one needs to relate that to pants distance on the original surface by some topological argument. But it turns out that each step in the subsurface moves you at most three steps or something in a simple case, but some bounded number in general. In the bigger manifold. Okay, and then one finishes when one simply sees a bunch of tori. So if your set of meridians cuts off a bunch of solid tori, well, a solid torus also with bounded area bounds a bounded volume hyperbolic three chain. Okay, and at the end of the day, that was what I needed to do. Okay, but let me just, in the last few seconds here, say that this is suggestive of a more general kind of picture. So because, in fact, I was using these geometric limit arguments to estimate volume. Yeah, sure. Yes. In the case when the injectivity radius is bounded below. And that actually explains why, in some sense, you need a slightly different definition for this P of H set. Because let's say you get down to the case when you have a separating meridian and you've got short curves as the generators of the free group. Well, those leftover solid tori have bounded volume, but you may still be a large pants distance from the meridian in that one-hold torus. Okay, so that means the pants distance will be out of sync with the volume there. But you can see something geometric happening as a result of that number, of that extra distance, right? Which is that this curve is getting short. Okay, so this is all stuff for, you know, the lunchtime discussion, but let me just sort of remark that we're actually really building more here. Okay, we're sweeping out volume, but we're really actually building a model as we go. So we're heading to the first meridian that we see, and with each step, we're finding a bounded geometry product region. What we need to make sure of is that we know what curves, or what it looks like, what the cross-sectional surface in that bounded geometry block looks like. If we know that information, then we're building a model. We can keep track of that, okay? So the idea then is, well, we see this, we look in the curve complex towards the set of all meridians, and we just need to show that what we're really doing as we sweep out these bounded geometry blocks is we're heading to the set of meridians, and that turns out to be true. So this gives us a way to start to build a model, namely some kind of bounded geometry product region, taking you from the bounded curve set at the boundary down to the first meridian, and then you split off and you start and you continue to build models for these legs. So this is the part that's joint with. So this is joint work in progress with Minsky, Damasi, and Soto, that this process should somehow continue. With various product region bits and then capped off at the end of the day by handle bodies of some kind. Okay? And this is a generalization of a really beautiful theorem of Hossein's, who proved that, who gave a model, let me just say he gives a model in the case when the Heegaard splitting has what's called R-bounded combinatorics. Okay, and this in particular ensures that the injectivity radius of M is at least epsilon, but it's not a necessary condition for that. Okay, so our work in progress is to give a necessary and sufficient condition for the manifold to have a lower bound to its injectivity radius and to use the corresponding combinatorics to build a model manifold. In terms of combinatorics, yeah. So I didn't say what R-bounded combinatorics is. So this is some kind of object that relates to curve complex and these sets P of H1 and P of H2, or just P of H in the case of the handle body. Okay, so let me go ahead and stop there. I think so. Yeah, so, I mean, you use it because you need to take a limit, a first geometric limit, okay? So if you're in the Heegaard splitting case, you can take a limit of hyperbolic manifolds admitting Heegaard splittings, but where is your base point supposed to go, right? So, and also, it makes facile the bound on basically this fact that you have this strongly reducible thing means that the universal cover of this piece is a cat minus one space So basically, it looks like a hyperbolic handle body, and you can start to interpolate. And yeah. Sorry. So you need this Pitts-Rubenstein minimal surface. So I didn't really use, it doesn't really use this really strongly reducible set condition. All you need is strongly reducible to get going, but the really strongly reducible case just tells you that the surface is that you're actually isotopic to the minimal surface. There's a case in the general strongly reducible setting where the surface can sort of collapse to a double cover of a non-orientable surface, and then there's a little one handle you have to add to get the machine running.